Welcome to Fried. I'm your host, Kate Donovan. I work with leaders so they can see the patterns that are quietly hurting performance and burning out their best people. In my world, burnout is blameless, burnout is information, and burnout is a signal that we can use to improve workplaces. Seasons 1 through 10 focus on individual burnout. Seasons 11 and beyond focus on leadership, culture, and the workplace. This podcast will help you understand what burnout is pointing to and how to start fixing what's actually causing it. If this is a conversation you feel your organization should be having, that's the work I bring into teams through keynotes, workshops, and advisory. You can find all my info at katedonovan.com. That's CAITDONOVAN.com.
Ain't gonna burn ourselves out no more. Ain't gonna burn ourselves out no more. Got each other on our side, plus all the folks at Fried, the Burnout Podcast.
Fried fam, I know that this season we have talked to a lot of people who are putting books into the world, and I'm doing that very intentionally because I want you to be able to listen to the episodes that you're getting and then dive deeper into people's work when it's stuff that really, really sparks you. And if you are in leadership of any sort, if you are in a director position, an executive position, a C-suite position, the books that we've been overviewing in the past month or so are going to be really, really helpful for you as you go through your career. This week's book, folks, is an encyclopedia. It's not fully edited yet, and I've read just the advanced reader copy, so I know that you're going to be missing some of the information that I had access to by the time that, because they're going to cut some pages. They're going to cut some pages, but Aoife O'Brien is the founder of Happier at Work and the host of the award-winning Happier at Work podcast, which is ranked in the top 2% globally. A culture and leadership expert with over 20 years of corporate experience, she works with global organizations to create the conditions where people can perform, grow, and stay. Her work focuses on aligning culture, drivers, and capabilities so employees feel valued, clear, and equipped to do their best work and organizations see sustainable gains in performance, engagement, and retention. Her debut book, The Encyclopedia, that has everything you'll ever need to know about anything, Thriving Talent, will be published March 2026, and this will come out probably sometime in March 2026 as well. So she'll be in prime launch time, which means it's the perfect time for you and go buy or pre-order the book, depending on when this comes out, because supporting authors in that way is incredibly important. So we're going to throw that out there. Aoife, welcome to Fried.
Thank you. It's such a pleasure to be here, Kate. I'm a huge fan.
I am so excited to have you. Aoife and I are writing for the same publishing company in the same series of books right now, which is how we got connected. So I'm super excited to have you. I'm just going to jump right in.
Great.
Thriving Talent literally talks about everything that you'll need to know. You have a framework, but within that framework, you literally didn't miss anything. Anything that could have an effect on the overall picture, you wrote about it. And I was like, Aoife must have been writing this book for a long ass time.
I've been thinking about writing the book for a long ass time, I'll admit. And it's funny, when you call it an encyclopedia, I'm like, do people like encyclopedias? Is an encyclopedia a good thing?
Yeah, it can be, right? Because especially if there's in the electronic version where you can do a search and you can pull up all the things you need all in one place.
That's a good point.
Right. It's critical to have all of this information and to see how it interacts with one another. And most of us are not actually taking the time to include all the pieces.
Yeah, that's a really good point, actually. And I think one of the frustrations, let's say, so we'll get into my career history, I'm sure. But when I left corporate, I went on and I did a master's in organizational behavior, and I was exposed to all of this amazing research. Yeah. And it really struck me that why don't leaders have access to this information in a way that is accessible to them? Because what I was reading were very academic studies and, you know, going academic jargon and reading the methodologies of how they conduct these studies. That's not what leaders need. Leaders need practical, actionable things that they can actually do, that they can do differently tomorrow.
Yeah. And I think that this is I've been thinking a lot. I'm recording an episode next week about how wellness is a little risky. These things we talk about, the soft skills, the wellness, they feel risky to people. They're not. The ROI is really clear. I have pulled all of the studies and I'm just going to like bang them out in this episode. But it doesn't seem to matter that we have all of those studies, because everybody knows that we have all of those studies and we're still in this like awkward space of like, but no, this literally has ROI. Like, what, there was a study that shows 470% return on investment in wellness initiatives. Like, what are we even talking about? You know, like, this, it's crazy. So I think that you're right, that getting some of the research baked down into the simplest way, hey, this is what you need and go run with it, is really important. And one of the things in your book is that you do have a framework, but within that framework, every section has doables. Every single section. There is not a section, folks, listen to me when I say this, there is not a section of this book that doesn't eventually get to the, and this is how you do this particular piece.
Mm, yeah. And I'm glad you said that. I'm glad you found that, because when I do my work, I tend to be quite practical. I want people to take action. I don't, excuse me. I don't want people to go away and feel really inspired, but then not really know what to do. You know, if you've ever attended an event, you're like, wow, that's amazing. I feel energized. I feel inspired. But maybe you're not clear on what that next step actually is. I wanted to make that next step clear for people. And it's not, you don't have to do everything either all at the same time. You can pick the thing that resonates most. You can pick the thing, you can take a quiz to find out which thing you should be doing first and focus on that.
Yeah. And I think that's why having the like encyclopedia style, you know, is important in this case, because you can go to, I'm having this problem. Open the book and you will get to a how-to. There's always a how-to. So I like that there's that grounded aspect of it. Now, before we go too far, why the heck do you do this? Because this is not always a grateful area to work in.
Yeah. That's very true. So I had my own experiences at work. You mentioned in the introduction that I have a 20-year corporate career. I, for the most part, during that career, loved my job. And I mean loved. I was in organizations where I really excelled, where I really got along with people. And a couple of times it happened that that wasn't the case. So in the first time, it was, you know, I didn't have the language for it, but something just didn't feel right after only 2 months of being in that organization. People were coming to me to ask me questions, people who had been there for years. So obviously, in terms of the day-to-day job and in terms of being able to carry out the tasks, I was being recognized in some way or is being appreciated by my colleagues. At the same time, I was being told by leaders that I was going to be promoted. It was written into my contract that I would expect to be promoted. And the company went through this period of change and I was not promoted, but it wasn't communicated to me. And as my mum always likes to remind me, male colleague was promoted to be my manager, but zero communication about what happened, why it happened. And I just found out one day because he pulled me into a room and he said, I'm your boss now. You know, he started talking about my clients and I was like, what's going on here? He said, I'm your boss now. When I complained, when I tried to kind of ask the leader who had made this promise to me, I said, what happened here? He said, oh, he's more like your supervisor. And if you want, you know, someone to support with your career, if you want to talk to stuff, you go to his boss. And I thought, this is crazy. So I didn't stay there too much longer. It was in a foreign country where I needed a visa to work. So it kind of made things a bit awkward. Either I look for another job where they can sponsor my visa, or I leave. And I ended up leaving and I traveled for a year. And it really knocked my confidence more, I think, than I care to admit, probably for about 10 years that I was, yeah, like a really long time. It was a terrible kind of awkward situation. He made my life hell. I made his life hell at the same time, you know, talking about going back to kind of being a teenager or being a child. all of this stuff came out. Why wasn't I chosen? And yeah, so I didn't make his life pleasant, but he definitely didn't make my life pleasant either. And then, so I traveled for a year. I had a nice break and I came back to the workplace and I worked somewhere else and I loved that job. And then I hated it. And then I loved it again. And then I hated it again. And I just got to the stage where I was like, I'm done here. I can't do this anymore. So I left with nothing to go to. And it was the first time I'd ever done that, because when I left the other role, it was like, oh, I'm leaving to go and travel the world. And when I left other roles, again, it was for travel. It was to move abroad. There was always a reason. Whereas this time it was like, I'm just leaving, full stop. I'm not doing anything. I'm just leaving. I do not want this anymore. And I went on, as I mentioned, and I did the master's and I started asking those hard questions. And I thought, OK, so what should HR have been doing? How did I get into this situation? And I started studying this concept of fit and what it means to fit in at work. And I was like, wow, this is the answer. This is everything. And so I became obsessed with this idea. And from the research I did, I came up with these three pillars of values, needs and strengths. And that has since evolved into what I'm now calling the Thriving Talent Framework, where I've added in the foundation of psychological safety, which I think is really crucial. And then the capstone of leadership, because I think we need to have the leaders in place to execute across these three pillars as well. And the language has evolved. So when I talk about values, I've kind of expanded that to talk about workplace culture. When I talk about needs, I've expanded that now to talk about drivers. And I also talk about the things that derail us at work. And then the third pillar is first started out as strengths and now it's more capabilities, because we don't just look at individual strengths. We look at how our strengths show up as part of a team, how to leverage complementary strengths and how to do that at scale as well in an organization.
So let's go through the framework bottom up. We're going to start with the psychological safety. And this is the part I told you before we started that I was arguing with you in my head when I was reading the book a little bit. And then you came around and fixed it before I had a chance to fully argue my point while I was reading. The
Good.
Psychological
I'd love
safety
to hear
part.
More about
yeah,
this.
It was so funny. I was watching myself do it and I was like, you are so silly. Like, this is not a conversation. But I was reading through it and it was, you know, the stuff that we know about psychological safety from Amy Edmondson and, you know, all the stuff. I mean, we don't need to go into all the specifics. And you were like, these are all the reasons that psychological safety might not be working. And you were going down the list and going, and my body, because most people that do this work are similar to you in that they've done some sort of degree in people management, organizational behavioral health, organizational psychology, something like that. And the thing that makes me different is that I come at this as a healthcare practitioner. My background is acupuncture and Chinese medicine, is energy, is right. Like, so I'm always thinking about how what I'm bringing to the office helps or hinders me. And not to say that everything is on the individual, but there are there are certain tendencies that we have. So you're talking about all these psychological safety things and what might be in the way. And then finally, there's this little paragraph that says, you know, if you have your own history of difficulties, maybe traumas, maybe some sort of like bigger situations that affect how you interpret safety, even when psychological safety is offered, you might not get it. And I thought, oh, there she is. And that's when I just started going down the this is an encyclopedia road, because I was like, she's literally covering.
Because I've actually addressed it.
Yes.
Yeah.
She's covering everything.
Yeah.
So when you think about psychological safety as that foundational piece. Oh, I know, like when you're doing it, you're sort of drawing it, right? Like you did this and then you did this at the top for leadership, right? So if you're not seeing the video right now, just imagine a foundation of psychological safety and a roof of leadership.
Bottom. It's a big block at the bottom.
A big block at the bottom. When you look at that big block, what do you think the most important thing for people to know is?
Oh, that's a deep question. I think what I'm hearing a lot, and I interviewed Amy Edmondson, subsequent to writing all of this stuff, I had the opportunity to interview her. So all of the great stuff that she shared on my podcast is not necessarily in the book, but it is to a degree. But one of the big questions I got in the run-up to that episode was this idea that being nicey-nicey is safety. Mm. And I suppose it's, and again, this has come up on the podcast before as well, it's the idea between feeling uncomfortable and feeling unsafe. And uncomfortable is okay and is expected, but you need to know the difference. And the other area was where people weaponize it. So you can weaponize it for good and say everything is fine here because there's no conflict, there are no arguments. So we've created a safe environment where no one fights. I'm like, that's not psychological safety. And then at the other extreme, just saying what you want or saying, I don't feel psychologically safe with you, and kind of weaponizing it in some way. So I think what people need to know is what psychological safety is. And it's that sense of interpersonal risk taking. It's okay for me to voice an opinion and people are not going to laugh and people are not going to say things behind my back. People are not going to judge me. They're not going to reprimand me in any way.
So here's the first pushback. Mm. Like, how likely is that?
It's mostly unlikely. And this is the other problem, that the majority of workplaces are not psychologically safe, but they either don't know that they're not psychologically unsafe, or they don't know about what psychological safety is, or they assume that they are safe because there's no conflict, that they've created this safe environment.
All right, so let's go back to this idea between uncomfortable and unsafe, because this is a really huge area of nuance that I believe is underdeveloped in this space particularly. And I think this is the core of why we end up weaponizing it, because we don't even want that uncomfortable bit. So if we feel uncomfortable and then we weaponize it, we talk about it in terms of safety when that's not what it is. So if you can, because this is not maybe a simple question, you might not have been ready for me today, Aoife.
I don't think I was, Kate.
Most people aren't. It's just how my brain functions. But if we could find some of that nuance, it doesn't have to be perfect, and we can maybe figure it out a little bit together. But how would someone know? Because there are like physical sensations, there are emotions, there are thoughts. There's like a whole, just that piece, the difference between discomfort and unsafe. How would someone know whether they're just uncomfortable or whether they're truly unsafe?
Yeah, I think it is such an important question. And I think it is really nuanced as well. And it does tie in with what you mentioned a second ago in relation to how we feel ourselves in our bodies and whether or not we feel safe in ourselves, and the impact that our entire history has on how we feel and how our bodily sensations show up. What I would say about psychological safety is how you can maybe test the waters, and you might feel it's uncomfortable to do this, but you test the waters and you share what's on your mind. You push back on something that a leader has said, or you call out something, or you share a new idea that people might think this is, or you fear that people might think this is a totally radical idea. There's no way we're ever going to do this. And you share that and you notice how it feels, and it feels uncomfortable. And I think the difference here is if people accept that idea, then you've felt uncomfortable and you've taken that step and you've kind of stretched your comfort a little bit. But if people laugh, if people say there's no way that would work here, then that's going to put up the defenses again. And that's going to be psychologically unsafe. And I think even if it's not the best idea, if people are grateful, if people are like, okay, so we have tried that in the past, maybe we could potentially try it, or thank you so much for sharing what's on your mind. It may not be the final idea, but it might spur on someone else's idea. I think we can use those clues in our body when we do take those risks. It is all about taking that risk, and we're going to feel uncomfortable. But where we feel unsafe, I think, is where we have to learn from the past. is this a fear that someone's going to laugh at me? Is this a fear that someone's going to? And if that repeatedly happens, if people keep pushing back, if they keep laughing, if they keep knocking back our ideas, then we're going to feel unsafe. We're not going to share anymore.
So this requires a certain amount of bravery and observation from,
I think so,
from the individual.
Yeah.
To find out what the temperature of the water is. Like, you're not going to find out until you put your toe in.
I think so.
Yeah. So, and one
any
of the
thoughts
things,
to add? Anything to build on that?
Yeah. So one of the things that I think is useful, there's an episode, I will, if I remember, I'll link to it, folks, but don't count on me. You can also look it up in the Fried episode finder, with an episode with Heather Hansen, a good friend of mine who was a trial attorney for a long time. And she created this system of observation based on her trial attorney days that reminds people that they have, you know, like, there's only one jury in your head, but there's two different attorneys, right, that are fighting. And the attorneys both have the same information. And how you move forward is only based on which attorney you're listening to. So when you have a situation pop up, it's going to be normal, she would say, probably in this type of situation, for you to be vacillating between the ideas, this is unsafe and this is uncomfortable, this is unsafe and this is uncomfortable. And you might be listening to both sides argue, but you have to, one of the things that she says is to, and I think this is a good idea, is to keep an evidence journal. And it doesn't necessarily need to be about yourself. So when you're new in an organization, you might start taking note, like actually writing down evidence that supports that this environment is psychologically safe. If you find a lot of it, you're probably going to be okay. Like, it's probably going to be okay for you to be psychologically safe in that environment too. But if you're watching other people speak up and you don't have anything to write down for your attorneys that will prove that you're psychologically safe, then maybe you should be a little bit more careful. So, but those are still, these are like outside things that we can do. And I think the other thing that we should keep in mind is that I don't believe most of us have enough interoceptive power, which means an ability to internally sense what's going on with us, to differentiate the sensations between uncomfortable and unsafe. Most of us cannot do that. I've been working in my body and meditating and since I was 18. I'm 43. I still can't do it. So if you can't do it, there's nothing wrong with you, and you're going to need to externalize it so that you can make a clear decision for yourself moving forward.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think either way, it's going to feel uncomfortable
in
your body when you do this.
Yeah. Your choice is between uncomfortable and, you know, just sort of trying it out and being okay, or unsafe and uncomfortable and trying it out and not. It's uncomfortable at the beginning either way.
I think we need to think of the outcome that we're trying to achieve. And I'm kind of have in mind, if we were asking for a raise, for example, it's going to feel super uncomfortable. And I've done this in the past and I've been told no.
Yeah.
And I've done this in the past and I've been told yes, or I've just been offered a raise, which has been even better. But it's that awkwardness that you kind of have to get through, but you need to focus on the outcome. I get more money if this, if I can get beyond this feeling of, I don't feel comfortable to share this.
Yeah. So for psychological safety, for this first foundational space to be present, we need leaders that will help guide, like you were saying, you know, not laughing and saying thank you and doing all the things that help provide the psychological safety. So we need leaders to be doing that part, and we need individuals to be taking risks.
Yeah. But we need individuals to be to be creating that environment as well. Because in my kind of the example of a psychologically unsafe environment that really sticks in my mind was actually from one of my peers, where she shot down one of my ideas. And I was like, oh, I guess it's not okay to share ideas here. You know, I had traveled the world, I had worked in lots of different places, and I thought I had this great new way that we could potentially work with our clients. And she said, that's not how we do things around here. And I thought, oh, okay, so this is the kind of culture I've walked into, you know. And again, I didn't have the language, I didn't really have the understanding at the time of what that was. But in retrospect, that was absolutely psychologically unsafe.
That's interesting to me, because while there is a beauty to openness, if that's literally just not how they do things and that's not in alignment with their values, then that information is fine.
Yeah. Yeah. Maybe it's how I perceived it then.
And maybe she could have said it in a different tone.
Different tone, absolutely.
Different tone, different set of words. But if the end result is like, that's just not actually how we do things around here, because that's not in alignment with our values, or because that's not, that would require budgetary changes that we don't have access to, or whatever. But in order for that to be a psychologically safe moment, there would have had to be probably more transparent information.
Yeah.
That would make it less about like, well, you're not fitting in, and more about like, you might not understand this yet because you're new, but there are reasons that wouldn't work. So, so that's why there's this, like, there's this constant sort of push and pull between that risk that you have to take and that feedback that you're going to get.
That's so true. And I think being open with that feedback is really important. Yeah. The irony here is that one of the values of the organization was open, you know, they were open. And it's like, to me,
what does that mean?
Means open to new ideas.
That but maybe means, it doesn't to them. And that's the
maybe then, it doesn't. Again,
right? Like, what if that means something completely different to them, but that's, it hasn't been clearly defined.
Yeah.
And then
That brings us nicely on to
doesn't it? Did you see that that beautiful segue?
Absolutely.
That we just created? Take it away. Tell us how this connects.
So values, again, this is, if I relate back to my own story, I knew about corporate values. You know, they were on the wall, they were in the email signature. I knew about those. And when I left corporate, I went, before I did the master's, I did a coaching diploma. And that's where I learned about personal values as opposed to corporate values. And then when I was doing my research, this idea, this was the master's research, this idea of values came up again. And I thought, wow, here's this thing, values again. What? This must be actually kind of important. So started digging a little bit deeper about that. And I understood that we all have values and they're inherent to us and they are embedded from a very young age and they tend to stay the same throughout our entire lives. And what I took from that was, it's important, and this is kind of how I started the seed of the idea. It's kind of grown a little bit since then, but it was the idea of alignment between my values as an individual and the values of the organization. And when I talk about that, it's not the expressed values, as in it's not the open that we say that we are. It's the felt experience of, well, when you say open, are you really open to new ideas, or are you really open, you know, are you open to, do you leave the doors open physically and literally, do you leave the doors open in the building so that we can walk in and out of people's offices, you know? So it's that, the really how you experience work. And when I looked back at my experiences of work, I could see that, like, a major clash between what I really value as an individual and how I was being treated in organizations. So that time where I was being told one thing, oh, you're going to be promoted, you're going to be a director, what kind of director would you like to be? And then at the same time, the kind of hidden nature of, well, let's promote this guy instead. He'll be her boss. She won't say anything. Also, she's on a visa, so she can't complain because, you know, who's going to sponsor her? Et cetera, et cetera. The golden handcuffs, I think they call them. Mm-hmm. And so when I look back and I just see, among other things, it was just a major values clash. And I think it's really important to understand as individuals what our values are. I think it's really important for leaders to be able to articulate and to demonstrate the behaviors that are expected in line with the company values, but also to be able to articulate how individuals' values connect with the organizational values. So someone could have, you know, it's really important for them to innovate and to continuously improve. Well, how does that link with our customer service as a value, or our innovation as a value? You know, things like that. I think it's just super important to understand how all of these things are connected and how you experience the behaviors at work and the impact that that might have.
Yeah. In the burnout research, one of the main drivers of burnout in the workplace is a values misalignment. And that values misalignment, they talk about in a couple of different ways. And the first way is sort of what you've been hinting around, but maybe not saying direct, is the misalignment between what the company says and what the company does.
Oh, yeah.
The misalignment between the values that are painted on the wall and the behaviors that you feel in the space that are tolerated and allowed.
That's the number one. Yes. Yeah, yeah. What if they're lying about this? What else are they lying about?
Yeah,
that's
breaches
kind of
how trust.
I perceive that. Yeah.
Yeah. So it breaks down trust and breaks down psychological safety. So without having that first part of the values aligned, you're automatically the foundation is starting to crumble, right? So that's really important. The next place we can have a values misalignment is between a manager and their worker. Right. So if you have a different way of working, like I am fast, I know that urgency culture is like a problem, but I'm just a fast person.
Yeah. Same.
So it doesn't feel like urgency to me. It just feels like get shit done.
It's normal.
It's
normal exactly.
For me, but there are people that process slowly, that work differently, that need the time to like sit with things and allow them to transform. I would rather make a mistake, but get it done. Then think for 3 days. And that's just a personal functioning. It's not, it just is what it is. So this between a manager and a person is the next place where the values can create a mismatch that can create burnout or other problems. And on the third place is that space that you were talking about between an individual and the company itself at large, right? So there's three different areas where this values mismatch can create a problem.
Yeah.
And so those are all huge. But when you talk about it, the thing that I fear, not when you talk about it, when I write about it, when I talk about it, when everybody talks about it, the thing that I fear is that, like you said, you have to know your own personal values first. And my experience tells me that most people are terrible at figuring out their own personal values.
Yeah. Yeah. I think for me, first of all, before I kind of share about values, I want to address what you've just talked about. You haven't described it as pace, but I call it pace, the pace at which I like to work.
Yeah.
I don't know, did it make the final cut in the book? Because I don't think when I was trying to explain it, I'm not sure I did a great job at explaining what it is. I like to work fast and get shit done.
Yeah.
Not everyone works like that, right. But I think it's an important part of culture that people, and so in broad strokes, you might say in a tech culture, things have to happen fast.
Yeah.
In a government body, things are going to be a bit slower and more bureaucratic.
Right. Banks and things like that will be slower.
Yeah. Yeah. And I do share an example in the book where I was trying to send an email to clients. So we could have sent the emails individually one by one, but we wanted to use a marketing software. And I had to get approval to use the logo, the company logo, from one of two people based in a different time zone for a company of 40,000 people. And so two people are, you know, the marketing people or the specialist email marketing people for the whole company. And we have to wait to get an answer. And I'm like, it would be just quicker for me to send these emails individually and be done with it. So that's kind of what I have to say about pace. On the values piece, I think there's a few things at play. So there are aspirational values, of course. Integrity is one of my top values, and respect and, you know, all of this kind of stuff. It's not necessarily, and that's okay as well. If integrity is not your top value, you have other things that are more important. I also think it's a long process to find out what you want. Me being the overachiever that I am, I think when I first did this, I had like 35 words. I was like, yes, I have 35 values. And it's like, no, it doesn't quite work like that. You probably should land on about 5 words. And as again, my thinking on this has evolved further. It's not about the words, it's about using a specific phrase to describe what that word means, because different words mean different things to different people.
Like open.
I was just about to say, you took the words right out of my mouth, Kate. Open to them might mean one thing, and I will have an expectation that if they say that the company is open or would behave in an open way, that it's okay for me to be open and share ideas. But that might not be what they meant by that word. And so for me, I feel like it's been an evolution. And I even say this in the book that, like, here's what I've landed on for now.
Yeah.
But I think, and again, I was trying to understand this in the and how we relate to other people, because our values should be how other people experience us. So it's not just what we say about ourselves, it's what others say about us. And so you may take something for granted, or you may not even know that you behave in a specific way. Like someone said to me a few years ago, I was like, I really value efficiency. And now I'm thinking, is efficiency one of my values, or is it my way of operating? Maybe it's not a value, it's just a way that I operate. It's a way I see the world. And she was like, oh, you're doing yourself a disservice. I think you're actually quite generous. And then when I thought about that word, I'm like, but am I generous with everyone? I'm not sure I am. I think there's a reciprocal nature to relationships. And if someone is open and generous with me, then I will happily reciprocate that. But I'm not necessarily generous with just anyone who comes along. So for me, it takes a bit of work. And an example of one of my And my publishers, your publishers as well, they're funny because they're like, oh, and they'll pick out very specific values that I've shared in the book and say, thank you for being excellent and thank you for being fun and thank you for being committed. So they are some of my values. But my value of excellence, I want to share this as an example, because I think if we think back to who we were as children, so I was always terribly curious as a child. I was, you know, asking why, you know, why, who wets the rain and how does that happen? But one example, we were on holidays and it was my turn to do the dishes. And I went out without doing the dishes. And so my neighbor came and said, oh, you know, you have to come back and do the dishes. Oh, chores. Oh, man. But when I was doing it, she expected that I would just do it like kind of half-assed. You know, oh, I have to do the dishes. She was like, I'm so surprised that you're doing that so well, even though I know you don't want to do it. So to me, that is my value of excellence. If I do something, I want to do it really well, even if it's not something that I want to do. And I suppose if you think about how those things show up in your life, how your values actually come to life through your behaviors, then I think that's a really solid clue as to what your values actually are.
I'm sure that you all are really tired of me saying this, but I'm going to do it anyway in case you're new. Susie Welch from NYU Stern has the best, most comprehensive values exercise I have ever seen.
Oh.
It only has 16 values. It doesn't include things like fun and kindness and things like that, because she said we should assume that like most people want those things. And she named them differently. But there's, if you're like, well, I don't want to take the time to figure it out and I don't want to stumble over it and I don't want to look back at that terrible childhood and figure out what I kept. Go ahead and go to the values bridge, thevaluesbridge.com. I do not get paid for that. I just find it to be an absolutely exceptional tool. The first one it helps you not only decide what your values are, but also helps you see where you're working right now and the gap between the two, and shows you where conflicts are between how you're living and what your ideal situation would be. And it's just, I've done values exercises now since probably 2000 and I don't know. I started acupuncture school in 2003. So probably my first one was around then, because this is part of...
Which
part
was
of,
only a few years ago, Kate.
Yeah,
it's only
23 years ago.
Stop.
No big deal. So I've been doing values exercises for a long time and I have found them to be tedious and incorrect, because we tend to, like you said, like we tend to go through the exercise and circle the aspirational ones, like you mentioned. We circle the things that we think we should be.
Exactly. rather than how we actually are.
Yeah.
I am going to check out that Susie Welsh one. I've never heard of that. And it's kind of like, Susie, if you're listening, you know, we could get some sponsorship going on here.
She's so good. Over 120,000 people have done the values bridge.
Oh, wow.
So they've really got statistics that like are based on solid numbers, and it's really wonderful. We have an episode with Susie either before or after this episode. So if you missed it or it hasn't come out yet, look for it because it's really worth diving into. Okay, so we have foundation psychological safety, pillar one values, pillar two.
Drivers. So this started as needs. And I look at, this is what my whole research was about, the self-determination theory, it's called. It's a theory of motivation, and it's about satisfaction of three universal needs that we all have. The need for autonomy, which is a sense of choice and control over what we do and how we do it. A sense of relatedness, which is how we get along with other people. And I've added in this little thing based on something, I think it was Adam Grant said it, but it's how we relate what we do on a day-to-day basis to the impact or the, you know, what we're trying to achieve, essentially. And then the third one is competence. So feeling capable of doing your role. Now, what the theory doesn't address is this idea, like I call it the Goldilocks effect. You can't have too much or too little. You have to have what's just right. And that's going to be different for each individual person.
Yeah.
So pandemic happened, and overnight we all had a whole load of autonomy. Some people flourished with more autonomy, and some people just kind of floundered and didn't really succeed at all. They need a lot more guidance. So it's beyond just satisfying the need. It's about finding the right level of guidance versus autonomy, of competence. You know, you don't want to be too stretched that you feel over your head, but equally, you want to have some sort of challenge in your role as well. So those are the universal needs. We also have unique needs, which complicates matters a little bit more. And how you know what your needs are often is when you feel really frustrated at work. My boss is telling me what to do. Okay, that's your need for autonomy is being thwarted there. You're feeling micromanaged. It could be, oh, I'm doing the same thing day in and day out. Maybe you have a need for variety in your role. So find out where you're feeling really frustrated. What are the things that frustrate you most about work? And it could very well be connected back to an unmet need that you have.
Amen. And I love this autonomy piece. And I like that you're saying that it's not about getting a, like everybody needs a 7 out of 10. No, no, no. You need to match, folks. What I'm throwing in need. The match again. You need to match your level of autonomy need as close as you can with the role that you are doing. Yeah. Same with competency, same with et cetera, et cetera. So it's, exactly. It's all the way through. It's about alignment and match more than it is about correct.
Yes.
Which poor leaders who have to help you figure this out.
Exactly.
That they have a team of 8 people and all 8 of them have different autonomy levels.
Yeah.
I am a person, folks, if you have not guessed, I've only ever worked for myself. My autonomy levels are through the roof.
If you ever went to work for someone else, I think you'd be like,
oh. Disaster.
Yes.
It's not a good idea. Mm. And my mother, on the other hand, is someone who doesn't want to have the responsibility that autonomy affords. She wants the list of things to do. She wants to cross them off and do them how you want them done. And then she wants to go home and not think about a damn thing.
Yeah.
Totally different ends of the spectrum.
That's okay.
Totally fine.
To be like that.
I need that person in my business, you know?
But sometimes we get in our own way where we're like, I should know this already. I should be able to figure this out on my own. And actually it's your autonomy need or your guidance need is being frustrated there that you actually need more guidance.
Yeah.
The other thing that I didn't mention that my thinking has expanded on this is this idea of derailers as well. Mm. So there's some things that are an inner drive. Think of things like, I want to always be right. Mm. I have this inner drive. I have to be right all the time.
Feels like you're calling me out, Aoife.
Me too. Being perfect, doing things quickly. There are things that are like an inner drive that probably came from childhood. Right. But it's things that we do and we're driven to do, but they're actually getting in the way of us doing our best work or getting in the way of us having our needs satisfied. So being right all the time is going to kind of get in the way of that connection need, that relatedness need that we have with other people. So I think it's really important to be aware of these things as well, that it's something that's driving you, but at the same time, it's actually, it's not doing you any favors.
Or it's doing you some favors, but not all.
Yes.
We talk about this a lot in the burnout space with perfectionism and hyper-independence and people pleasing, and they have
now
functions.
You're speaking my language.
Right? Yeah. Like if they didn't, if they didn't have functions, we wouldn't use them. But to the query that I give people in those spaces is, do I have to abandon myself to engage in this behavior? If you can engage in perfectionism without self-abandonment, go for it. If you can engage in people pleasing while staying true to yourself, and not neglecting yourself, cool. Like, I'm fine with that. So those are similar derailer ideas, right? Like, if you can do it and maintain yourself, fine. But if it's costing you authenticity, it's costing you attention, it's costing you, then that's what derails, right? So that, I like that idea.
Or if you're putting other people, is that kind of what you mean? Like, you're putting other people's needs first, essentially. Yeah. You're like, I'm going to make sure that they're looked after.
Yeah.
It doesn't really matter because my needs are not really that important. Do I even have needs? What are my needs?
Who? Needs?
Yeah.
Me?
Exactly.
No way.
Exactly. Well, well, this is another thing that I will say, that I didn't know that I had needs at work. If you had asked me, I'd be like, well, I don't know.
I'm fine.
But I think when we use that language, it can make for an awkward conversation. Whereas if you say, what are your frustrations at work? What bothers you? What are you annoyed about? What's getting in the way? That kind of language, I think, opens things up a little bit more than saying, I have these needs and these needs are not being satisfied. Or a manager asking, what are your needs? When someone's like, I didn't even know that I had needs.
Am I allowed
to? Especially not in the workplace.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So we have values, we have drivers, and we have
capabilities, which started as strengths. Yeah. And I think this was the chapter, so the entire section on drivers was the one that just flowed out of me because it was, a lot of it was based on the research I did for my master's.
Yeah.
I think the capability section was the one that interested me most because I'm just so fascinated by this idea. So I look at strengths on an individual basis and understanding our strengths as leaders, understanding the strengths that we have within the team. And I suppose recognizing that everyone has strengths and maybe they're not playing to their strengths. Some interesting non-academic research that I did on LinkedIn, I did a poll a number of years ago, and 86% of people said they weren't reaching their potential at work. Yeah. And it was about 200 respondents. So it was a huge, you know, statistically significant, I would say, but not academic research, you know, just kind of a poll on LinkedIn. But I thought it was really interesting that people's perception of not being able to reach their potential. And it's like, how do we tap into that potential? Well, I think one step is to understand what strengths we have. It's certainly not something that I ever spoke about when I worked in corporate. We don't really talk about that. We may talk about skills. We may talk about someone who is like, I remember from our team, oh, Claire is really great on Excel. But what's that underlying? What's that underlying strength that she has? Is she logical? Is she methodical? Like, what are those things that are driving that kind of really strong skill? So understanding what our strengths are, but then also at a team level, you don't want people who all have the same strengths. You want people with complementary strengths, but people with complementary strengths may antagonize each other. I'm thinking big picture and detail oriented person. So big picture is like, oh, and this is the vision. And the detailed person is like, but how are we going to get there? And they're like, well, that's your job. You need to do the step by step. And so I think the detail oriented person will say that person is dreaming. We're not going to achieve that. And the dreamer will be like, this person is a stick in the mud. And, you know, they're so focused on the how, they're not really thinking about the what, and they're dreaming bigger. So that's at kind of the team level, really understanding that dynamic. And then the third chapter within that is at the organizational level. So that's thinking about learning, thinking about automations. How do we use AI? I was also a bit wary about talking about AI in the book, since like the time between when you finish writing and when it gets published, the AI well and surely has moved on at that stage. But I did want to at least address it, and the fact that we are using it at work now, and, you know, understanding how do we grow organizational capacity by understanding whether people are in the right roles to really capitalize on the strengths that they have. You know, touched on internal mobility and understanding and using software to really understand what do you have, because I think a lot of organizations are starting to talk about that, but they're not necessarily doing it.
Yeah, and they have a lot of data that they are not necessarily interpreting and putting into place.
And I come from a data background, so it annoys me if I see that there's a whole lot of data available and you're not analyzing it, you're not using it, or you're not making decisions based on it, then that will frustrate me.
And that can be hard in a global type of company, because you might be making decisions from the data on a global level, but that might not necessarily work if you've got, you know, an office in New Jersey and an office in Bangladesh. They're going to require a little bit of a different take on things. I know there's a major global, one of the biggest companies in the world, I'm not going to name them, but they're going through some centralizing all of their processes over the past 5 years or so. They've been in this process. And I know this because I have someone on the inside. And as they centralize their processes, things are breaking down in drastic ways.
Yeah,
they,
it is not me.
Working. Yeah. At
it's all. A cost-saving thing, but actually it doesn't work decentralizing processes like that when you have local operations.
Just wild watching everything crumble as they try to make things easier, because they're not taking into account all of these cross-cultural needs and values and things that are different in different places. It's been fascinating to like look by the side and just be like, wow, that is not doing what you thought it was going to do.
And you know, you can be sure that there's some consultant getting paid a few million to
not
oversee
this. I'm sure billion. It's more than a few million. I'm sure of it, because this is one of the biggest companies in the world. So this is really interesting to watch this happen and see the decisions they're making and like watch it trickle down and just be like, yeah, but you can't do it like that here, because the law doesn't even allow it.
Yeah.
Like crazy things that they're not taking into account. So it's really
legal
wild
stuff is
everything, awkward. Everything.
And I've been through that internally in my own organization, but then also when one of the client organizations was, they were centralizing their reporting and I had to oversee that project. And I was just like, it's just, they took the responsibility away from the local team. They moved it people into a global role. And it was like, it's just not.
Just doesn't work that way.
Can't.
Not in every place. Yeah. So, all right. We are coming up in the top of the hour, but we still have got to get through leadership. So we have psychological safety. We have values. We have drivers. We have capabilities. And we have the capstone leadership.
Yeah.
I got to this part. And this is sort of in line with how I feel most of the time. And I thought, these poor leaders. This is a lot. Mm-hmm. And there was a study done, I don't remember where it was, but a study done that said that leaders, people managers, are only spending 22% of their time with people.
Okay.
So they're supposed to understand, they're supposed to provide psychological safety and understand values and needs and capabilities and drivers and all of their individual people. They might have 8 people, they might have 50.
Yeah.
Like,
where do they find the time?
Where do they find the skills?
Yeah.
This is a huge, just think about how much time you've studied to come to these things.
Mm.
And we want leaders to be meeting KPIs, to be attending all of the things, to be taking care of the people, and to be providing all of this support so that people can function well. And then when things break down, all we talk about on LinkedIn is how it's the leader's poor fault.
It's the leaders.
It's their fault. Leaders, I have so much compassion for your position, and I'm shocked that people are still even taking the job.
Yeah. So yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Let's talk
about, do we have a choice? That's the other, maybe we start there.
Right?
This is the thing. You know, if you give people an option, would they choose to be a people leader, or would they choose to be a specialist in their area that they really excel in? So that's something I address at the kind of the end of the leadership chapter, is not everyone wants to be a leader. Not everyone is equipped to be a leader. But this was a tough chapter to write. The first iteration Let's say I did it kind of a bit more quickly than I could have. And I got feedback from my publishers going, okay, yeah, great, great, great. And then the leadership kind of lets you down a little bit. So I took some time away and I got thinking and I was like, what do I need to say here? And I started by talking about self-leadership and how it's really important for us to first lead ourselves, to grow in self-awareness, to understand the role of emotions. I touch on attachment theory as well, which I thought it's just a fascinating thing, and how we relate to other people and what might be triggering us or making us feel uncomfortable at work. I talk about conscious leadership and the towards moves that we can make and the away moves that we can make when it comes to being a more conscious leader. And then it's only then that I start talking about what it takes to lead others, sharing examples of terrible bosses that I've had and examples of the best boss that I've ever had as well. And what are the traits that are associated with that? But also to say, if you're a leader, it's not your fault. You're under pressure. Like we talked about the time issue as well. You know, it's if you don't have the time to do all of these things well, it's because you don't have the time and maybe you're short with people and you just are under so much pressure that you default to getting snippy with people and whatever that might be. But it's about really, I suppose, understanding ourselves and how we can connect with ourselves and how we can better connect with other people by understanding ourselves better.
Yeah. And there's a study, Kristen Holmes, who's the head researcher of Whoop, you know, the one of the wearables, wearable trackers. Yeah. She was on the podcast a couple of years ago and she released some research just last year that, and I don't remember the percentages, folks. So I'm just going to give the general idea because my brain does not hold all those numbers. But something about when a leader has 45 minutes less sleep than they need per night, the psychological safety of the team decreases by a certain percentage.
Oh, wow.
Right. So not only do you as a leader need to do this self, find these self-awareness pieces, understand these values and needs, sort of do this extra work. It should be a university degree at least to do all this extra work. But on top of that, you have got to take care of yourself on the pure physical level, because when you don't, that affects your team, even when you have the right mindset.
Yeah, yeah. But if you think what that 45 minutes means, that means an extra show on Netflix because you were like, oh, I'm really into this show, want to watch an extra show.
Or your kids puking.
Or your kids started puking.
You know, like
puking.
It could be anything.
Yes, yeah, yeah, yeah.
It could be anything.
It could be I'm getting up early because I didn't get finished yesterday what I needed to get finished. It needs to get out by 9 or whatever it might be.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's so many different things. And I know like that's something that I've noticed, especially as I've gotten older, is if I don't get enough sleep, I just can't function the next day, you know? And if I'm at a party, even if I'm not drinking, I'll wake up the next day and I feel like I'm hungover because I've missed out on 2-3 hours sleep because I wake up at the same time every day. Just naturally, that's just my body just wakes up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So leaders, I think that the one of the core messages here is we hear you, we see you, do the best you can with what you got.
Yeah.
But this is a big job and maybe no one told you how big it really was.
I don't think people realize. I think it's kind of presented as a progression, like, you know, the next step for you is to manage a team of people, when actually I think what we really need in place are people who care about other people to be in those positions as leaders. Yeah. And you're saying like a study showing 22% of their time is spent leading people or with other people. It's like, how do we shift that so that they're doing less of the individual contributor work and their sole role is to develop other people and to see, you know, and I know you had Zach Mercurio, to make sure that people feel that they matter, to actually spend time doing those really important things rather than doing the role of an individual contributor.
Yeah, this comes up all the time with so many people that we need to have strategic leaders and we need to have people leaders. And those shouldn't always be the same person.
No.
All right.
And I did speak to someone on my podcast who was, his sole role was a people leader. I thought, amazing.
Yeah.
He's not doing the day job. His only job is to manage the people, to lead the people.
And sometimes those roles are pushed into an HR position, but they don't need to be.
That's probably a topic for a whole other podcast.
Absolutely.
And my own opinion as well was, why aren't HR stepping in here, thinking that HR is all people related stuff, when actually a lot of it should fall into manager roles?
Yeah. Yes, you're right. That is a whole nother conversation. All right. So we have a space. What you have created in this book, I believe, is a space for people to continuously come back to. This is one of those things that people are going to pull off their shelves or pull up on their Kindle and go back to over and over and over again. I want people to understand that this is an incredible resource, that you don't have to go look other places for the information, because the basic information that you need is already in this book, Thriving Talent. Aoife, if there was one last thing that you wanted to share with people as we wind up, what would it be? And then, of course, all of the where to find you and all those extra things.
Yeah. I think we've covered a lot today. And it's interesting, like, you know, going back to this idea of it being an encyclopedia, there's actually a lot that didn't make the final cut for word count. Yeah. And there's so much more that I wanted to say. And for anyone who pre-orders the book, I'm including bonuses. But, you know, if anyone has any questions, they can always reach out to me. So I think we've kind of done a great job on covering all of the basics and the really important things. A final thought would be, get psychological safety right first. When I first started writing the book, and I do write about this in the book, psychological safety was kind of bundled together at the end with leadership. And then I thought, do you know what? I'm going to move this right to the front, because it is and it has been the foundation of the model. So we need to get this stuff right first before we start thinking about the others, because it makes everything else so much easier when we can get that psychological safety stuff right first.
I love it. And Aoife, where should people find you, find the book, and et cetera?
Yeah, so I'm very active on LinkedIn, so feel free to find me there, but I will spell my name. It's spelled A-O-I-F-E, and as Kate very kindly pronounced, it's pronounced Aoife. So A-O-I-F-E, Aoife O'Brien, and that's spelled the Norway way, which is with an E. And that's, if you want to search for me on LinkedIn, you'll find me there. And if you want to find out more about the book, you can go to thrivingtalentbook.com.
Aoife, thank you so much. And for those of you who don't know, the spelling of my name is also Irish. And if you called me Coach, I would not think that was weird.
Nice. Spoke to someone last week and I said, is it Caitlin or is it Coachlin? And
yeah,
she said, it's Caitlin. Thank you for asking.
Yeah. But I don't mind either way. I'm good with it either way. Aoife, thank you so much for all of the both intelligence and heart that you put into this book, that you poured into this work.
Thank
to
you.
Allow other people to thrive.
That. Thank you.
All right, Fried Fam, let us know how this goes. Dig into this book, and we'll see you next time.
Welcome to Fried. I'm your host, Kate Donovan. I work with leaders so they can see the patterns that are quietly hurting performance and burning out their best people. In my world, burnout is blameless, burnout is information, and burnout is a signal that we can use to improve workplaces. Seasons 1 through 10 focus on individual burnout. Seasons 11 and beyond focus on leadership, culture, and the workplace. This podcast will help you understand what burnout is pointing to and how to start fixing what's actually causing it. If this is a conversation you feel your organization should be having, that's the work I bring into teams through keynotes, workshops, and advisory. You can find all my info at katedonovan.com. That's CAITDONOVAN.com.
Ain't gonna burn ourselves out no more. Ain't gonna burn ourselves out no more. Got each other on our side, plus all the folks at Fried, the Burnout Podcast.